This is a podcast from BBC Radio's news and sports station,
5Live.
To find out more about 5Live and its sister service, 5Live Sports Extra, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5Live.
Hello to you all, downloaders of the 5Live Film Review podcast. As I'm sure you can tell, this is the voice of neither Simon Mayo or Mark Kermode. It is me, Richard Bacon, sitting in for Simon and Mark, and joined this week by Boyd Hilton and Nigel Floyd, hired largely because their names kind of rhyme. Enjoy, and next week, Wittertainment with Simon and Mark will be back as normal at 2 o'clock.
Let's talk about films.
We are going to do a fulsome review of some movies a bit later. Boyd, yes. Tell us what we're going to look at.
So we've got The Ghost, I think, is possibly the main release. Robert Harris novel, have you read that novel, Richard? You're on it. I mean, interesting politics. You should. The Ghost, it's very interesting. It's clearly based on Tony Blair. And this is the film directed by Roman Polanski of the best-selling novel by Robert Harris, starring Ewan McGregor, and it's interesting in all kinds of ways. It's topical because it has a political element to it. It's kind of a political conspiracy thriller type of film. It's interesting because it's directed by Roman Polanski, you know, who's currently under house arrest, and it's interesting in all kinds of ways. So that's probably the main film. We've got Cemetery Junction. We had Ricky on last week, and you had Steve on as well, didn't you, earlier in the week? We kind of said we both really liked it, but we'll fulsomely review it this week because it came out this week.
Okay. No, I haven't read The Ghost, and it's a commentary as well. It on Tony Blair.
Absolutely.
Making a comment about Tony Blair.
Yes, it's very obviously based on Tony Blair and his wife, Cherie. And, you know, the characters are so clearly similar. And I don't even think Robert Harris denies anymore that it's very clearly obviously based on those people, is he?
Yes, except the fact that Pierce Brosnan is playing our former Prime Minister, which does slightly throw you off the trail, I think, you know, in the sense that he's a little bit more handsome than Tony Blair ever was, and he looks not even slightly Bambi-like.
Blair could be quite flattered by this whole thing.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure he would be.
Floyd, Cemetery Junction, just before we review it, I've seen lots of adverts on the sides of buses. I haven't seen any adverts on telly. I don't really watch a lot. Probably
there are some ads on telly.
Has it had a big push or not? Do you think we're really aware of it?
Yeah, I think people are getting behind it. I mean, certainly Ricky and the guys have been on every radio show and television show going, you know,
Thank you for pointing out that was not an exclusive interview that we had with Ricky Gervais last Friday or Stephen Merchant last Wednesday. Thank you, Boyd. I thought it went well.
Yeah, it went very well.
Has it had... Are people aware that there's a Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant film coming out next week?
I think so, because it's not... I know what you're thinking. You're thinking there's one film out every week that's just on buses. But this isn't one of those. It has had TV advertising, definitely. I've seen adverts for it on TV because they quote one of my quotes from my review in the magazine. So I'm fully aware that it is on TV as well, and in tubes and everywhere. So I think they're giving it a big push, yeah.
Okay, Floyd, what else are we looking at?
We have Dear John, which is what used to be called in the old days a weepy or a women's picture. It's quite dreary, but we will go into some detail about that later on. And we have Repo
Men. He teases you with his
which is about
review.
And Repo Men is about as far that way on the spectrum as you can be away from Dear John, because it's definitely aimed at geezers. It's a hardcore sci-fi film about people who go in to recover, with large kitchen knives, bits of people's innards that have been lent to them by a vile corporation.
With Jude Law. Jude Law doing a
big American
mainstream film.
Is this the film that's been really hammered in America?
Yes.
I think I was in America when it came out.
I was in America when it came out.
It had some real stinker reviews.
Yes, absolutely.
Is it dreadful, Boyd? You can tell us now.
Do we want to give it away?
No, we don't.
We don't. It's absolutely bizarre is what it is. That's the one. It's fascinatingly odd, I think.
Yeah. If anyone remembers the old Monty Python sketch where John Cleese turned up, I think with Eric Idle, to recover the liver of somebody who hadn't quite done with it yet, and then proceeded to do so with quite a lot of blood being splattered about. It's pretty much that sketch done like Blade Runner.
It makes it sound all right.
It's one of the goriest films of recent times, definitely.
Okay, we'll talk more about it a bit later. I just remember a review in America saying essentially, why is Jude Law in this film?
Yes.
I'm going to play an interview that I conducted last week with Steve Carell and Tina Fey in a moment. Boy, this is date night.
Yes.
Not at all surprising that these two have been brought together for a rom-com.
No, I guess that you could say they're the two most popular, admired, successful, critically acclaimed TV comedy stars of our time, really. That Steve Carell in the American version of The Office, Tina Fey in 30 Rock. And those two shows, I have to say, are the best current American comedies, yeah. I think.
They are.
Of them.
Yeah.
And they're both brilliant shows.
And both on NBC, both on the same channel.
Both on the same
network.
Channel. Both of those stars are fantastic. So this feels like someone said, all right, let's give them a comedy thriller, give them some juicy roles, and they'll be funny. It'll be great.
Are we reviewing it next week? Is it this week?
It will be reviewed next week.
Okay.
Not by us, sadly.
Yeah, by Mark Kermode.
By the good doctor.
So it's called Date Night, and they play, Steve Carell and Tina Fey play a married couple called the Fosters, who, during their weekly date night, steal a dinner reservation, which turns out to have been for a pair of criminals who a number of unsavoury people want bumped off. Here's a clip in which the Fosters try to convince a couple of heavies that they are not the couple they're after.
I want to talk to your boss right now.
I think we both know that's not going to happen, Mr. Triplehorn. Or should I say, Phil Foster.
Next time you make a dinner reservation, don't use the same alias as your ransom notes, genius. Ransom note? Did you really think you could steal from Joe Mileto and get away with it?
Okay, someone somewhere is making a huge mistake.
Yeah, guys, seriously,
this is
just a big, big, goofy misunderstanding. Yeah. We are Phil and Claire Foster. We don't know anything about a ransom note.
You were sitting at the table. The girl at the front said you were the Triplehorn.
Okay,
Let
me explain. My husband, very sweetly but delusionally, thought that we could make it here early enough to get a table, and we didn't. We were late, so they were very rude to us.
When we heard them
calling the reservation for Triplehorns, he was like, us. And
that's...
so we took it.
So you just took somebody else's reservation?
For the record, I was against it. But my husband gets these plans in his head, and it becomes like a thing.
I'm an idiot sometimes.
Shut up.
One might call it a classic case of mistaken identity. So I spoke to Steve and Tina last week, and I started by asking about the state of the Fosters' marriage in the movie.
At the beginning of the movie, our characters are married for a long time, and they have two kids, and they try to carve out this once a week where they go out and do something, and it's incredibly boring. They go to the same place, they eat the same food, and they sit around. All they do is like look at other couples and try to come up with something to say. And so I think, you know, Steve and I are both married in real life, and well, hopefully we're not quite that desperate. We definitely related to the fatigue that marriage and young children can bring.
Yeah. Steve, did you bring anything of your own marriage to this?
Well, there's a scene in which my character leaves cabinet drawers and doors open, and I tend to do that in real life. And my wife hates it as much as Tina's character in the film.
Okay. There's a marvellous scene, Tina, where you're wearing a gum shield in the bedroom, and it's very funny.
Oh, what? No. You just put in your mouth guard. That usually means we're not going to...
No. We could still fool around.
Only if you're into it. I mean...
No, I would love to. Let me just get the
blood. Yeah, okay, you know what? No, it's... honey, I'm totally fine if we don't.
No, I just, I would love to. Let me just get my head around it.
Okay. It's totally cool if we don't.
Are you sure?
Mm-hmm.
Because those potato skins made me kind of gassy.
Let's just do a rain check.
Okay. Are you sure?
I will light up your life next time.
You're two of, we'll come back and talk about the film at the end, but you're two of NBC's biggest faces between 30 Rock and The Office, and I can understand why they've brought you two together. I'm amazed that either of you have find the time to do it. First of all, with The Office, how many episodes of The Office do you make a year?
We have, all together, we've made 126 episodes.
See, that's hard for us to get our head around. I think there's 14 British episodes of The Office.
Yeah, well, they're 14 fantastic episodes, so I think Ricky was very smart in the way he planned that, because it's a classic, you know. He has like a perfect 14 episodes of TV.
Actually, you're in The Invention of Lying, of course.
Yeah, I'm in The Invention of Lying for about 2 minutes, and I just shot with Ricky for 3 days, so I don't know him well, but I do know he's really funny.
Yeah, he's great. And we're a bit obsessed with The Office on this show, Steve. We went to Scranton. We took this program to Scranton and broadcast live from there a few weeks ago.
Did you?
Yes. And they love you in Scranton.
They're so... You know what? They originally thought that we would be making fun of Scranton, and the show's had the opposite effect. I think... For the first time in 50 years, there's been an uptick in population in Scranton. So it's kind of made them cool again.
They were telling me about various stars of The Office who go there. They have conventions and there's an office tour that you can go on around Scranton, even though most of it's filmed in a studio. Have you been there at all yourself?
I used to go to school in Ohio, so I would drive through Scranton in order to get there, but I haven't spent any appreciable amount of time there.
Actually, what's interesting is as you say, you don't take the mickey out of Scranton. In the American office, you're affectionate towards Scranton more so than the British office is towards Slough.
Yes, I think we have kept our relationship very, very good with the residents of Scranton. Right. And next year, I think we're hoping to actually do a bit of filming there and maybe appear in their local parade. We'll see.
You'll get mobbed. They're mad for you there. Tina, you write 30 Rock and Steve, you co-wrote The 40-Year-Old Virgin. Were you, Tina, comfortable relinquishing control for a film like this?
Yeah, it was good because Sean Levy, the director, he was very inclusive of me and Steve, and with each new draft of the script, he let us kind of give our input. But it was a real vacation to not have to be the one sitting down and typing and figuring out every detail. And it was a holiday.
Okay, I'm pleased to hear it. But I come back to that point I was making a moment ago, Tina, that between filming all those episodes of 30 Rock, there's 20-odd a year on there, and writing them, I'm amazed you've find the time to make movies as well, frankly.
Well, I've got just one little window a year between April, May, and June to do something else, and that's why it was the thought of getting to do something with Mr. Carell seemed worth ruining my vacation for.
I was watching The Daily Show last night, and we kind of get it over here a day late, which made me think of both of you. First of all, you, Steve, because you were a correspondent on there, weren't you?
I was.
It's been quite a breeding ground for talent, that show, hasn't it? Between Rob Corddry and Ed Helms and Stephen Colbert. It's quite a remarkable program. And Tina, I thought of you because they were talking about Sarah Palin on there.
Yeah, what'd she do?
She's out campaigning for John McCain.
Yes.
At the moment.
And she's got a snazzy black leather jacket.
That's right. Yes, yeah. She is wearing a snazzy, very tight, quite 1980s looking black leather jacket. I think, isn't McCain in danger of losing his Senate seat or something?
Some guy's challenging him, right? Another Republican is challenging him. Right?
That's it. I think he's an American talk show host who's really right wing. So I think they consider John McCain not to be right wing enough.
Can any of us ever really be right wing enough?
I don't think so. Those impressions of Sarah Palin, they obviously made you a household name outside of America because 30 Rock plays over here. Saturday Night Live doesn't really play over here or in that many other countries. So it's a big deal for you and good for you. But do you think people read too much into those impressions? I think some people thought that was an attempt by you to bring down Sarah Palin.
To control the American government.
Yeah, exactly.
What I thought, I got up in the morning and thought, how can I control the American government today? It's because I live in the Upper West Side of New York, which is like the most kind of liberal enclave on the East Coast, maybe. And so now to this day, I'll be walking down the street and someone will come up to me like, thank you for changing the world. And I've gotten to the point where I just go, you're welcome. Like, I just stop trying to talk them out of it.
Did it bother you for a while that people saw it as so overtly political?
Well, it was strange to me because, you know, Will Ferrell had played George Bush for years and Dana Carvey had played Bush Sr. And I do think there was a thing because it was two women that they kind of thought it was personal or it was vindictive in some way, but because they weren't used to seeing ladies in politics as much, I guess.
That is an interesting point. You're right. When blokes portray male politicians, no one bats an eyelid. It's just a bit of fun.
Yeah, Will Ferrell plays George Bush like he was a moron, but no one seemed to think that he was going at him too hard.
Yeah, I'm not sure how many other ways there are to play him. Steve, do you still keep up with The Daily Show?
You know what? I generally go to bed before The Daily Show is on, I have to say. But I still am in contact with John and Stephen. And I think I'm going on the show next week to say hi.
The standard they keep up is remarkable. There was an episode they did last week, which was a parody of Glenn Beck on Fox News, where the whole episode was like an episode of Glenn Beck's show, where Jon Stewart was just ranting nonsense.
Does he
rabid.
Cry?
Say again.
Did he cry?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, he did a little cry. Talks about America's enemies. But yeah, he was spouting rabid nonsense. And it was, you should go back and have a look at it. It's great. Did you both come from, I think, the same school of improv comedy in Chicago, Tina, is that right?
Yeah, we both started at this place called The Second City in Chicago, which is a improv comedy theater that's been there since 1959.
And is that, do you see yourself, Steve, as an improv comedian at heart?
You know what? It's something I sort of stumbled into. When I decided to become an actor, it was just merely that, just to become an actor. And by virtue of the things that I was cast in, I think that sort of informed what the rest of my career was going to look like. And Second City was a great learning ground for both of us, really. We would have 8 shows a week in front of a live audience to test out all sorts of different sketches and characters, and it was a great place with an enormous amount of room to fail.
Tina, looking at this film, Date Night, it would appear to me that there's some improv in this film.
Yeah, there is a fair amount. We always shot the scenes as scripted, but then Sean Levy, the director, encouraged us to kind of go back and certain sections and play around if we wanted to. And I'm actually really pleasantly surprised how much of the improvised stuff stayed in the movie, because a lot of times so much of what you improvise gets thrown away. But there's a little something in almost every sequence.
And Steve, I like the end credits. You've got the outtakes, which I like. That reminds me of stuff like Naked Gun. I mourn the days from when they used to put the outtakes at the end of a film. I think it's great.
Yeah, it's fun. It gives people a little inside glimpse of what shooting every day was like, and generally there was a lot of contained laughter, if not bursts of laughter, because everybody, and all the way through, because there's a great ensemble in the movie and everybody was funny, so there was a lot of comedy being generated every day and a lot of stifled laughter.
Good stuff. Listen, nice to speak to you both. Tina, what are you doing next?
I'm going to have a little bit of a vacation after this. I'm going to go back actually next Saturday and host Saturday Night Live again.
Great.
And then hopefully have a little vacation, and then I go back to 30 Rock in the middle of June.
You are almost entirely the product of Saturday Night Live, aren't you? Because you were just a writer on there. And then they, at some point, Lorne Michaels, who's in charge, put you on camera.
Yeah, I was the writer there for 3 years. And then I did a segment of the show called Weekend Update, which is a news segment, for 6 years.
What made Lorne Michaels, you think, take you from the writer's room and put you in front of the camera?
He's very lazy. he didn't want to go to any scouting at a comedy club.
And Steve, just finally, what are you up to next?
I start shooting a movie in about a month, and then back to the office in August.
How long will you stay with the office for? How many more series? How long's your contract run?
Contract through next season.
Okay. And will you stay after that?
I don't think so. I think that'll probably be my last year.
That's enough, Michael Scott. I like that line that you said, where if you don't know a Michael Scott, then you are Michael Scott. Date Night is out on the 21st of April. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks, you.
Bye.
They're nice, aren't they?
Very nice.
Boyd Hilton's here. Boyd is here. Yes, that, Boyd.
Have you seen any of she did the...
You're going to ask me what she looked like when I met her,
I'm going to say that. No. Saturday Night Live, which she hosted...
Down the line.
Saturday Night Live, which she hosted last Saturday in America. The clips, she did Sarah Palin again, fantastically. And new sketches of Sarah Palin, brilliant.
Floyd, hello there.
It would
there.
Have helped, however, had they found a film where two such comic talents could shine. We'll leave it to the good doctor to give the final analysis on Date Night, but suffice it to say, it's a date I would not like to have been on.
Let's talk top 10. Boyd Hilton is here.
Yes.
Floyd, Nigel Floyd is here. At 10, Boyd.
10 is Bounty Hunter.
What is The Bounty Hunter?
Bounty Hunter is a romantic comedy starring Jennifer Aniston and Gerard Butler.
And you love it. It's your favourite. It's your film of the year.
I don't think it's anyone's film. If you can find someone whose film of the year it is, I would give you some money. I would give them some money. I would be astonished. It's one of the most mediocre and
you're
uninspired.
You're a snob. That's what you are.
No, not at all.
Millions of people enjoy that film.
Oh, I love trashy films if they're good.
Heat readers will really enjoy that film.
Even romantic comedies are the staple of our magazine, but even we had to sit back and think, this is so mediocre, so average, so uninspired, so formulaic, that you couldn't possibly say it's good, and it isn't.
That's that, then. Let's go over to Floyd. At 9, Shutter Island.
Yes. Ornate, bloated, self-regarding, vacuous, a total mess.
Okay, everyone I know who's seen it, I haven't had time to see it yet, absolutely loves it.
It's
Boyd?
Great. It's brilliant. It's great fun. It's beautifully made.
It's entertaining, isn't
it? It's hugely entertaining. The interesting thing about Shutter Island is when I was in New York, and they kind of, it's been a huge hit. It's taken over 100 million in America, over 10 million here. And they were kind of advertising it all over again because people are going back to see it a second time. But it has a very interesting ending, one of those endings that makes you re-examine the whole story. Now, even saying, some people, one guy on Twitter got annoyed with Dr. Kermode for saying that it's got a twist. So if some people get annoyed, even knowing that there's a twist in the film, I think this is a new topic of conversation as to whether, can you even say there's a twist? Obviously, there is a twist. And I think it's fine to say there's a twist in the film. The actual advertising campaign in America was, there's an amazing twist in this film. That was the whole campaign of advertising. And I think people like to know, and they're intrigued and fascinated, and it's a good twist.
This thing, Floyd, about it being a bloated mess, I sometimes think with film criticism, you can really overthink a film. If you go into a film and it's quite entertaining and distracting, I kind of thought this with Avatar, and same with last night's leaders' debate.
Hang on, entertaining and distracting. It was distracting. I was distracted all the way through.
If it's entertaining, it
was boring.
It really wasn't entertaining at all.
And then more boring, and then stupid, and then stupider, and then more boring.
I'm going to tell you my point I was going to make. Yeah. So, like, the leaders' debates last night were quite flat for a lot of it. Nonetheless, it was still fascinating, sparked conversation. I think that with Avatar, it's worth the money. You come out, you'll talk about it. It's fascinating.
I agree with that. Yeah, you can pick holes in it, but at the end of the day, Avatar is in many ways hugely entertaining and an event and full of spectacle. And that's what people want when they go to spend a lot of money in the cinema. I would agree with you. I know what you're saying, yeah. And certainly Shutter Island is a spectacle.
OK, let's talk about number 8, Whip It. What is Whip It?
Well, Whip It is the Drew Barrymore film, which is about roller derby, as they call it over there. It's kind of a girly film. It's a little bit too soft at the edges for me. The interesting thing about the bunch of films we were given to review last week, and I'm sure that The Good Doctor does this on purpose, is that not one of them, apart from Whip It, opened in the top 10. So there was Shelter came in at number 12. The Infidel, the David Baddiel written film.
That it's not came on in enough cinemas to make a top 10, is it?
This week. The Infidel is going to be on twice as many screens.
Why, is it doing well?
It's doing okay, yeah, and I think it will be in the top 10 next week.
Okay.
Yeah.
And there was a very interesting art movie called I Am Love, which, interestingly enough, came in at number 11 above the two commercials.
We're going to have to do it quicker. We've only got to Whip It. You think it's all right, that film?
I really enjoyed it. Yeah. I think it's highly enjoyable.
Number 7, Boyd, is Remember Me.
Remember Me? Now, this is a kind of very intense romantic drama starring Arpats, and I think it shows, it hasn't been a huge hit. I think it shows that Robert Pattinson isn't necessarily the guarantee of success if he's not in a vampire film.
The draw isn't him.
No.
The draw is the Twilight saga.
Exactly. Also, this also has a big ending.
Let's go to number 6, The Blind Side.
The Blind Side. Sandra Bullock won an Oscar, of course. I thought it was interesting to see her playing somebody who was white, Christian, Republican, and yet sympathetic. You don't see that a lot in American cinema.
It's actually true. Hollywood don't make many films with people that they're not often sympathetic to ultra-Republicans. Let's go on to Alice in Wonderland at 5, Boyd.
Yeah, huge, gigantic hit, but just didn't need to be in 3D, annoyingly. We can talk about 3D endlessly. But I really liked it. I just didn't think it needed
to be. But it is quite
3D.
Boring.
I didn't think it was boring.
It's neither Alice in Wonderland nor Through the Looking Glass. They've sort of merged them together a bit, haven't they?
I didn't have a problem with that.
Oh, so they know better than Lewis Carroll.
When they're making a 21st century film, possibly they do.
I reread Alice in Wonderland a couple of years ago. It's amazing. You know, it's astonishing.
It's you can get a great version of Alice in Wonderland on the iPad, by the way.
I actually read it on my iPhone.
There you go.
Other products are available. Nanny McPhee at number 4.
Yeah, The Good Doctor thinks that Nanny McPhee and The Big Bang is as good as, or possibly better than, the original, but it's not, really.
At 3, Kick-Ass.
I loved Kick-Ass. Roger Ebert, the esteemed Roger Ebert, gave it 1 star, opens this week in America. He gave it once, very controversial,
He should go for a drink with Christopher Tukey of the Daily Mail.
He really should.
Let's go to number 2, How to Train Your Dragon.
One of the very few films that's recently used 3D to some effect, and a terrific story and a great family movie.
Okay, well, what we could do is keep everyone in suspense for number 1. A bit like Chris Tarrant on Millionaire, when you think you're going to get the answer and you don't, and he goes to an ad break. We're doing that with the number 1. And we want to talk more about 3D, because Scorsese is talking of making a film in 3D. Is that confirmed? Is that definitely happening?
Astonishing, yeah.
Which means that The Good Doctor is wrong about 3D.
No, it doesn't.
Well, let's explore that on the other side. It's films on a Friday, Boyd and Floyd are here, ladies and gentlemen. We were going through the top 10 quite a long time ago, weren't we? The top 10 has probably changed since we started talking about
absolutely,
it.
Absolutely, yeah.
We got to number one. We hadn't revealed the UK number one. Boyd, what is it?
The UK number one, Richard, is Clash of the Titans.
Clash of the Titans.
Retro, actively fitted in 3D.
Floyd, remind us what number two was.
Number two was How to Train Your Dragon, which uses 3D properly. Clash of the Titans, of course, retro fitted. I was wondering the other day whether the Advertising Standards Authority would accept a complaint on the basis that these films are not actually in 3D but are in retrofitted 3D.
It's still in 3D.
And for much of Clash of the Titans, it's not actually in 3D, because if you take your glasses off, you can see the 2D bits.
Yeah, but if you retrofit it in 3D, it's still in 3D. It's not as good as if it were filmed in 3D with 3D cameras with both the lenses, but it's still a 3D film if you retrofit it in 3D.
Yeah, I'd like to see you try.
I would like to try, yeah.
You may be wasting your time.
You
fancy just paying a lawyer a lot of money.
But the point stands that the difference between a film made in 3D properly is big, and Clash of the Titans is pointless in 3D.
Let me read some emails out. Tom says, "Hi guys, in last week's show, Richard suggested that the fact that the two 3D movies grossed more than Kick-Ass, a non-3D show, suggested that 3D was more popular. A key thing that Richard seems to have missed is that 3D movies cost more to see. If Kick-Ass could charge 30% extra on the door, their gross take would increase as well. All that 3D has proven so far is that people are willing to pay £3 more per movie, except for me, as post-Avatar, I've stuck resolutely to 2D only. That said, if I could be guaranteed that my 2D fare would be more of How to Train Your Dragon and less Clash of the Titans, I'd happily pay more. Also, I wonder if you've noticed that the ads for How to Train Your Dragon say also in 3D, which I rather like because of the suggestion, our movie is awesome, 3D question mark, well, it's there if you want it. And here Richard says, Stephen Romford on Clash of the Titans, this is my first 3D movie and what a disappointment. It was poor without the 3D. It is rubbish with 3D, which was highlighted every time they showed Liam Neeson on Mount Olympus. If you are inclined to see this movie, only go to the normal distribution of this movie. Otherwise, nothing to see here. Please move on. Yeah.
Or get the original on DVD, which is much more fun. It's 10 times more fun.
Martin Scorsese has announced that he'll be making a movie in 3D, Boy. Just tell us a bit about this.
It's called The Invention of Hugo Cabret. It's a children's film. It's based on a children's novel. And it is an astonishing moment, because I do believe in the many, many discussions of 3D that have been had on this show in recent months, that the good Dr. Kermode quite rightly would say, you know, when Martin Scorsese, you know, one of the best, if not the best director in the world at the moment, it makes a film for you, then we'll all have to kind of sit back and think about it. And now he is, as is Wim Wenders, another kind of great director of our time, also making a film in 3D. I mean, what's left? If Woody Allen does one, then we'd all have to give up and admit that actually the whole world has changed and now everyone's making films in 3D. I think the reason it's depressing for people like
wow,
us.
He's not funny in 3D as well.
Yeah. See, he's funny sometimes. Vicky Cristina Barcelona was great.
Actually, you're quite right. That was good.
Yes. But anyway, the point is, this great director who, you know, you'd think would not be interested in gimmickry, and 3D is a gimmick. At the end of the whatever you think of it, it is a gimmick. Is relenting and making a film in 3D. I think it's interesting that it's a children's film, though. For me, that's slightly makes sense, you know, children fighting. I've been to see lots of 3D films with my niece and nephew, and they love it, and the excitement of being on the glasses. That
Avatar proves that 3D works for non-kids films.
If Martin Scorsese makes an adult film in 3D, then we'll all
well, but James Cameron has made an adult film in 3D. Well, he has, and it worked.
Yeah, but he's
obsessed adults with went to see
think,
it.
No, I think the test case is if Martin Scorsese was going to make an adult drama in 3D. In other words, a film that would otherwise have been, you know, a grown-up film, like an R-rated movie in 3D, aimed at adults, then it may have arrived. And all the time that it's only for children, then it's still a gimmick. It's still a fair
ground. I mean, Avatar, the whole conception of Avatar is that it's using all the technology at our disposal, CGI and 3D, to make this, in quotes, immersive, technologically spectacular event. That's the conception of the film. And I think that's different, you know, to a great director making a film, making his latest film in 3D.
Adult movies will eventually use 3D. And by that, I mean actual proper adult movies.
Oh,
because that's ultimately what
that's
it's really
happening.
Suited to.
Of course, yes.
There is actually a 3D movie called The Stewardesses, which has already attempted that particular
Is that
idea.
Right? Mm. We'll start with you, Nigel Floyd. What is The Ghost?
The Ghost is a Polanski film which does what the Scorsese film mentioned earlier absolutely failed to do. It's supple, it's funny, it's lightweight, and it's exactly the kind of film that Hitchcock, the master of suspense, would himself have made. Now, it is an old-fashioned movie, but by that I mean it's a movie that makes sense. It's a movie that doesn't cut every single scene into about 1,000 pieces when you don't need to do that. You just need to put the camera where it needs to be and let the actors do their work. It starts with Ewan McGregor. He's a ghost writer. It's not a supernatural film. He's a ghost writer. His job is to finish off a memoir that's being written by the ex-prime minister, who is not unlike Tony Blair in some respect. He goes to a seaside retreat where he's holed up trying to write this. At the moment that he arrives, a big controversy bursts open because he is accused, somewhat topically, of having been involved in the illegal rendition of alleged terrorists by British agents working on behalf of the CIA. If we hear a little clip, you'll set up the idea.
You know the worst things about my life? You get so out of touch. Everything's done for you. You don't drive, you don't carry money. If I need cash, I have to borrow it from the protection boys.
This is the kind of details we need in the memoirs.
I couldn't put that in. People would think I was a complete idiot.
No, not at all. No, this shows what it's like being Prime Minister. That's exactly what the readers want to know. How does it feel to run a country? How does it feel to be so cut off? How does it feel to be so hated?
Well, thanks a lot.
And so loved.
Is it a good film?
It's a fantastically good film, I think. It's one of the best films I've seen this year.
Is it? Not,
yes, it is, Richard, in case
really
you're wondering.
No, but
it is a very, very good film. And the reasons are as follows. It's in classic Hitchcock territory and it's classic Polanski territory. The previous ghostwriter mysteriously fell overboard from a ferry and was washed up dead on the shore. Ewan McGregor is now moving into that same position. It's not unlike Polanski's The Tenant. He even is given the same bedroom that the previous dead ghostwriter, now a ghost, used to live in. And as he gets closer and closer to the Prime Minister, to his wife, played brilliantly by Olivia Williams, and to a rather too personal secretary that the Prime Minister has, who's rather sexy, rather too sexy, one might say, he begins to get very paranoid about what's going on. He then discovers some photos and some hints of some kind of conspiracy involving the Cambridge University years of the Prime Minister, which suggests that he might in fact be some kind of CIA mole.
Now, Boyd, that's an entirely fictional story. However, it's been written by Robert Harris, who was a political journalist who knew Blair, and this is meant to be not an allegory, perhaps it's saying, it's meant to be saying something about, it's a comment on Blair in some form.
Absolutely.
What do you think it's saying?
Well, I read the novel and the novel was fantastic, and you come away from the novel thinking this is a novel about, it's a novel setting up a conspiracy thriller, which is completely fictional, but using the idea of a prime minister who could well be accused of being involved in war crimes, and that, you know, and there are many people who think that of Tony Blair, and so and he's also, his character is someone who's very concerned about image, about style over substance. He's kind of, as you heard in the clip, actually, you know, slightly paranoid about being regarded, you know, as being regarded as not a particularly good prime minister because of the war that he got the country into, and the fact that his wife is a kind of lawyer, and the wife, as Nigel said, brilliantly played by Olivia Williams, is very similar to Cherie as well, rather more beautiful, but nevertheless rather similar to Cherie.
But you both agree, it's a terrific film.
Absolutely agree with Nigel. It's and what it is, what's so great about it is it's almost made as if the last 15 years of filmmaking didn't happen.
In what way?
It's
not in 3D.
It's not in 3D. It's not edited as if, you know, there's no tomorrow, and every scene, as Nigel pointed out, you know, every shot lasts half a second. It's stately. It's beautifully made. There's a lot of detail. It's not even that much happens in terms of action. It's a thriller in which there isn't that much action. It's quite talky.
Polanski's on good
but
form.
But it's really compelling. Mm. Every single scene is absolute. Every single scene advances the story, advances the character. It's just a classic piece of filmmaking, and it's just incredibly refreshing, isn't it, to sit down, watch a film where just the story and the characters and the acting and the filmmaking are all absolutely classy, beautifully done, and I just hope people go and see it.
I'll go and see it based on your enthusiasm.
Honestly, you'll love it because it's political. It is about, you know, it reflects on recent political events.
Polanski makes
very
good films, typically. Yeah. He's a great filmmaker, though, isn't he?
I don't want to spoil one of the best scenes in the film, but suffice it to say that there is a scene in this film in which Ewan McGregor gets into a borrowed car and realises that the satellite navigation system is set for the last journey made by someone, quite possibly the guy who was his predecessor, who's since been washed up on the shore.
Nice idea.
And that sequence is one of the best individual sequences you are going to see in any film in your life.
And even though Ewan McGregor's accent, I always think I get slightly annoyed when there's a southern accent, and I don't think it's very good. Even that doesn't matter because everyone's very good.
I'll definitely go and see it. Did you see the Have I Got News for You joke about it last week? Do you want to have
No, I didn't see it last week.
Floyd, did you see it? Yeah, well, you were busy watching Have I Got News for You when the leaders' debate was on.
What was that joke? Tell us.
The film's been given a 15 certificate. Polanski swears it was 18.
Oh, yeah.
It's not a bad joke.
That's a good joke.
Let's move on to Cemetery Junction, which we've talked about a lot on the show already. Stephen Merchant and Ricky Gervais were guests last week. You like this.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about it quite a lot last week, so I don't think we need to go into a huge amount of detail. But just to say, the reason I think we need to review it again, or at least talk about it again, is because I do think it's an absolutely fantastic piece of filmmaking by Ricky and Steve. It's to quickly set up again, in case you didn't hear them talking about it on the show different times last week, it's basically about three guys growing up in a fairly banal, dull British provincial town in the home counties in 1973. They're kind of frustrated by life in their different ways. They want to escape, they want to do something more interesting, and I think we can hear a clip that sets that up now.
Buy a policy.
No.
Who's going to pay for your funeral?
I've got a few years yet.
Not with all that fat round your heart. I know I'm not paying for it.
Like, you'll still be around when I go. Bury me in the garden if you want. I don't care.
Yeah, he buries everything in the garden. Got an old mangle down there, old cooker.
Not paying the council to take away rubbish.
Well, you better start digging a hole for him soon, because I'm not doing it.
You won't be alive when I die. You'll all be buried down there with the mangle.
That remind me to do that next week, Kath.
Dad, buy a policy or I'll be out of work on Monday.
Good. You can help me dig your grandmother's grave.
That's you heard Ricky Gervais. Ricky plays the main character, Freddie's father, and he does say that a lot of that is autobiographical. His dad did bury loads of stuff in the garden. I think his family, that element of the film, is very much based on real life, based on his parents. It's Julia Davis there, played the mother, who's fantastic.
Yeah.
Ricky's very good in the small number of scenes he's in, and everyone's very good in it. But in a way, those scenes are the funniest scenes in the film. They're the ones that are kind of the slightly broader, slightly more comedic ones. The rest of film is pretty much a drama, I would say, about, you know, kind of in the Saturday Night Fever mold of young people wanting to escape a kind of dull world and wanting to be cool. And the film was beautifully shot. There's great music in it. David Bowie, Elton John, Led Zeppelin. It's a rare British film that looks and feels like one of those great American films like Diner, about teenagers or, you know, people in their late teens, early 20s growing up and wanting to escape. And it's got that cool, almost timeless quality, ironically, even though it's very specifically set in 1973. And why I think I wanted to mention it again, I think that people have almost been not quite noticed how good this film is, because it's made by Ricky and Steve, and they've made probably one of the best British comedies ever, The Office, on TV. I think they haven't quite noticed, actually, even though this isn't that funny and isn't meant to be, it's a brilliantly made, really affecting, really emotionally moving piece of filmmaking. And we've both seen it twice now. I went to see it again recently, and the hairs on the back of your neck stand up in the last kind of 10 minutes of this film, when they're all kind of trying to work out a way of escaping this life. And it's just brilliantly done. And I think it's got a lot of 4-star reviews. One 3-star review in The Guardian, I thought, was really didn't acknowledge the greatness of this film. I think it's possibly a classic piece of timeless filmmaking that in years to come will be really, really well regarded. People will realise, actually, that was a pretty brilliant piece of filmmaking there.
Floyd?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, most teen movies...
Would you go that far?
I wouldn't go quite that far, because you can't compare any film to Diner, which is the greatest teen movie ever made and will never be surpassed. It simply can't be. But the Saturday Night Night Fever reference is interesting. Of course, it was an English director who made that, although it was made in America. It does have that kind of blue-collar feel about it. But one of the things that they do in teen movies, which is often a mistake, I think, is that the world that the teenagers or the 20-somethings inhabit doesn't have any adults in it. What's interesting here is that the lead character is trying to get out of his situation by not doing the factory job that his dad did, but by sort of joining this rather anonymous insurance company that's run by Ralph Fiennes. And then there's another guy who's married to his ex-girlfriend who's working for the insurance company. He's sort of aspiring to be him. So there are lots of adults in it. And then, of course, there's Emily Watson as Ralph Fiennes' wife, who just gives, in a few scenes, one of the most heartbreaking performances you're going to see this year. And it is very, very well done. And it's perhaps not the film that people were expecting from them first time out, but I think they've done a good job.
Will it be, as Boyd says, in a few years' time, will people go, that was an absolute classic?
I'm not prepared to put my life on the line about that.
Mark my words. Honestly, I think so. I think people... And interestingly, it's it opened on Wednesday and people may want to, you know, email or...
It's already opened.
It's already opened. Opened on Wednesday. And I was so pleased because on Twitter, loads of people I follow on Twitter, people I don't know from Adam, were saying, I went to see Summer Junction, I wasn't expecting anything particularly great and I absolutely loved it. People are going to really love this film. It's incredibly warm-hearted and incredibly inspirational in a way. And that's why I'm kind of so excited. But that's why I'm kind of... I admit I'm possibly going over the top about it.
Well, you're in it.
I'm in it for half a second. But even with even without that, and even the fact that I wasn't a huge fan of Ricky Steves' work, I think it's a fabulous film. Yeah. I think this and The Ghost are two classical pieces of filmmaking, both very old-fashioned.
I enjoy the texture of this film. It feels... I don't remember the 70s, but it has an authentic quality about it. It feels... It's a slightly glamorous version of the 70s, at the same time as feeling like an authentic version of the 70s. Because which they sort of did with An Education as well, I thought. Yeah. And I often look at these films and I think... It must be quite exciting as well to be a prop buyer and a set designer and a costume person
the
on these
sorts of
movies.
The thing they understand is this. When you live in a working class family in the 70s, which I did, you don't realise you're living in a working class family in the 70s. You think that's your life. You live within that world. You know there's something out there, but you don't quite know what it is. You're reading about it in The Face in NME, but you don't really know what that other world is. You just know that you want to go there.
And also, when you hear a song like "All the Young Dudes" by David Bowie, you kind of, it kind of inspires you, and that and it has that feeling of they're listening to that stuff, loving it, and it's inspiring them. They want to live that life.
Thank you. We shall have a look at Repo Man, which I know is your film of the week. So we'll we'll come on to that
it
in a moment.
May not be.
If you have seen Cemetery Junction already, given that it's been out nearly 48 hours, let us know very quickly what you thought to it. You agree with Boyd here. 85058. People text quickly. Well done, Simon in Beckenham. Cemetery Junction. I went to see it on Wednesday. Good light entertainment. I was 19 in 1973 and out of my first sales job, operating in a 3-day week, so I could very easily identify with the period it was set in. Strong links with other films. Traces of Spring and Port Wine, a classic. Brastoff, another classic. And the ending is straight from The Graduate, a third classic. I'm afraid Cemetery Junction is no classic, but nonetheless pleasantly entertaining. The lead character of the three lads is the double of Steve Hawley of Cockney Rebel. I imagine you more or less agree with that, Floyd and Boyd, you essentially wouldn't. James says, I saw Cemetery Junction on Wednesday night. I thought it was brilliant. The best film I've seen this year. Nice coming-of-age story with a great cast and a nice heart. Not the film I was expecting, but a brilliant debut by Messrs. Gervais and Merchant. Also just finished the audiobook of Ghost. If it's as good as the book, it should be terrific. Is it as good as the book?
It's. I can't imagine a better version of the book. I really can't. Like it's different. There are differences, key differences, actually. But in terms of getting across what the book's trying to do, it is as good as you'd expect.
Yeah. What's Dear John?
Dear John also came out on Wednesday. And is a romance. Am I doing Dear John? I'm doing Dear John.
I don't know if you can do it. I've never heard of it.
Dear John, well, did you ever see the film The Notebook?
Yes.
The Notebook. The Notebook's kind of become a bit of a classic romantic film in retrospect. It wasn't a huge hit when it came. It did okay. But in terms of on DVD and on TV, people absolutely... It's almost like the Shawshank Redemption of romantic dramas, I think. It starred Rachel McAdams, Ryan Gosling, and people absolutely loved it. And it was a very, very effective and affecting romantic drama. This is from the same... Nicholas Sparks wrote that novel, Notebook, and he wrote this novel, Dear John. He's the kind of modern master of very romantic, very kind of weepy novels. And Hollywood loves adapting his novels, and pretty much all of them have been adapted. There's another one coming out in a couple of weeks, because they capture young people, you know, in love, and they do capture that feeling. This one stars Channing Tatum and Amanda Seyfried, and let's hear a clip.
We move around a lot, so letters tend to come late and out of order. We may want to number our letters from here on out, though, just so we know which order we wrote them in. But when they do finally get here, it's a good day. Whenever they don't.
All right, let's see here. Not for me. Not for me. Not for me. And not for me. Figures.
That's not.
Sorry, dude, not for you either.
But I know they'll still come. I know it.
So you heard there Channing Tatum reading a letter that he'd written. So the thing about Dear John, as the title indicates, and he is literally called John and he's writing letters, it starts off with a fairly standard Hollywood meeting between a beautiful guy and a beautiful girl, and they fall in love. He is a soldier working in the Special Forces. Just 9/11 arrives in the middle of this film, and then they're split apart. He has to go off to mysterious locations and be a soldier for the Special Forces. She's stuck back home with a rich family, cooing over horses and stuff. So in the middle chunk of this film is literally the two of them writing to each other, separated. Him reading out letters, like you heard in that clip, her reading out her letters, and loads of montages of them mooning and mooning
Sounds
about
awful.
Each other. The whole middle chunk of the film is dreary, dull, tedious. And you think, what didn't they ever realise? This whole novel is written in this form, that it's not going to work. If you split the two characters apart for the whole huge middle chunk of the film, and it's just about them writing to each other, it's just completely undramatic, dull and dreary. So the first half hour is kind of all right. It's perfectly pleasant. The ending is kind of vaguely interesting. There's lots of ridiculous stuff in the middle. And there's loads of terrible, terrible stuff about autism. They use autism Ooh. As a kind of plot point. They use 9/11 as a plot point. Ooh. It's absolutely shameless.
Your message is clear. Don't go and see this film.
It is. Whereas The Notebook was almost like a classic of this form, that a romantic drama can be good and starred great people, Ryan Gosling, Rachel McAdams, two actors. Channing Tatum is no Ryan Gosling. He's got an incredible jaw and a great body, and you see him topless the half of the film, but he can't act. I mean, she's fine. He's awful. Totally without any charisma whatsoever.
Okay. Yep. Amanda Seyfried definitely needs to get a new agent, because she's a very good actress, but she's been in quite a lot of very bad films.
Dear the film, dear John, I will not be coming to see you under any circumstances.
Quite
Cemetery
right.
Junction, excellent feel-good film. Tom Hughes was great. I went to see Cemetery Junction yesterday, not expecting much, and thought it was fantastic. Made me feel that Gervais may have turned a corner when it comes to film. Gave me faith that him and Stephen Merchant can still write superbly, says Ross in Newcastle. Ben in Bristol. I went to see Cemetery Junction at a screening. I thought I was watching a weak ITV drama. I would not pay to see it at the cinema.
That's outrageous.
We've got one more film, haven't we? Oh, Repo Man. Your film of the week. Floyd, tell us
Repo
why.
Repo Men, not to be confused with Alex Cox's Repo Man. So, it's the near future, and the near future looks a lot like Blade Runner, as it mostly does. Jude Law and Forest Whitaker are a pair of kind of mismatched buddies, and their job is as follows. They work for a competition run by slimeball Liev Schreiber called the Union. The Union basically hires out or rents out internal organs that they have made. So they're kind of basically made of some futuristic material. At the point when you stop making your payments, they come round with a very large knife, slice you open and recover the goods. There is a very good and very nasty 85-minute exploitation film buried somewhere deep in this movie. But the director, Miguel Sapochnik, obviously had rather grander ideas about what this film was going to be about, and he tried to make it bigger and more sort of significant in a way which is quite irksome, to be honest. Now, I take my hat off to Jude Law here, because this is not the kind of film you would expect him to do, and it's certainly not the film you would expect Forest Whitaker to do just after he won an Oscar for The Last King of Scotland. So they both obviously believed in the project at some level, but something must have gone wrong. I mean, there's talk in the notes about a 25-minute sequence being removed, like a backstory thing, and I think that's the problem. The film got too big, and it probably got out of control. It's a first-time director, and it just doesn't really get to where
it's headed. I said
this
earlier. I was in the States when they were reviewing it. Got terrible reviews. Jude Law's in it. Yeah. People are like, what's he doing there? Yeah. Just quit in a nutshell, boys.
Oh, I went to see it. I paid to see it in America. It came out when I was in New York.
Well, wasting your time in New York.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, for this show. And what's amazing about it was, at packed audience, everyone was talking on their phone. No one was paying the slightest bit of attention. Then suddenly there's a scene to watch till the end, most gory scene in recent cinema history, which is kind of a love scene slash we're going to put our hands in each other's bodies scene. scene. Then everyone shut up. And that lasts about 5-10 minutes. Then everyone starts talking again. It's awful.
Well, that's it for the Five Live Film Review podcast. As I said at the beginning, Simon and Mark are back next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.